Hey everyone, today's quilt episode is going to focus on the systems and expectations of healthcare that we currently have. We're going to shine the light on some inequities and give opportunity for further inquiry. Last winter, Dr. Cunningham joined us to discuss the differences between traditional medical model and functional medicine. He exposed the holes in traditional training when it comes to nutrition and lifestyle medicine.
Welcome to the Healing Ground Movement, a podcast dedicated to revolutionizing how we think about our bodies and our health. I'm your host, Dr. Carly Hudson, DC, and I have lived my life in pursuit of holistic healing and care that goes beyond symptom management. If you've been listening and like what you're hearing, head over to your favorite platform and leave us a review so we can reach more people with our important message. Enjoy today's episode.
Could you talk a little bit then about sort of the difference between your traditional medical training and what that next level of creating an integrative or functional medicine approach is? Because I think there's a lot of assumptions about what traditional medical training knows and says about the physiological symptoms. And I certainly hear often in my practice that an MD will say that you know, diet is fine, but it's not really going to move the needle. And these things aren't really going to do anything. So what's the education and an assumption that's kind of happening between these two schools of thought?
Yeah, you know, in conventional medical training, diet doesn't really enter into much of anything anytime.
Mm-hmm. Do you get dietary instruction in your education?
Yeah, we had a week.
Okay. So one week of diet nutrition.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, it's interesting to think about it. It was back in the second mm-hmm. year of medical school.
Yeah.
And I actually, it was actually impactful for me.
Oh, good.
In a way, because they talked about, now this is back in the like mid-80s, mm-hmm. okay, you know, but they talked about, you know, eating more vegetables and it was mostly that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, you know, so I really tried to implement it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really understand how to integrate that into my lifestyle at all. And so I probably mm-hmm. spent more time cooking than maybe I should have mm-hmm. if I would have been a little smarter about it.
Yeah.
But I was trying, mm-hmm. you know, because I could see the value of it.
Yeah.
But then, you know, it eventually just kind of evaporated away, you know.
Yeah.
And because nobody at medical conferences ever talked about, you know, dietary things. Now, the one difference is probably in when it comes to diabetes mm-hmm. and heart disease, heart failure. To some extent, doctors, conventional, you know, doctors would talk about, you know, salt intake. They'd talk about carbohydrate intake, and they, to some extent, talk about, you know, fat intake and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And a lot of that was, I would consider, kind of misguided now.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we can talk about that.
Yeah,
you know,
well,
a little later, but
because a lot of the recommendations for diabetic diets and everything have changed. That, you know, higher good fat diets are far more impactful as opposed to the no fat diets that were originally prescribed.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, we're learning so much. I think is the real
right.
takeaway.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, mm-hmm. if I answered your question,
yeah, I think it's a fair point. It's something that we've talked about through my training and, you know, years back in the 80s, looking at the numbers. It seems like it hasn't changed much. Maybe it is changing now that it's more than a week. But from what I understand, traditional medical training still has, you know, about 10 hours of nutrition. And that's, you know, and then it doesn't get repeated and the drum doesn't get beat on it. But what we find with chiropractic and functional medicine is that becomes one of the main tools in our toolbox,
right.
you know, that we had two quarters on it and loads of continuing education available about not just what Eat More Vegetables can do, mm-hmm. but what finding food sensitivities and good fats and implementing nutraceuticals, which is a way of talking about supplements that are at a very high grade level, you know, better than the over-the-counter that might be, cheapened with fillers,
right?
But using high grade supplements to fill in the pieces, it's a drum that's beat really hard in other circles.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe, and traditional medical training has a lot of other really fantastic tools,
right?
That when our bodies get so beyond what we can bounce back from, mm-hmm. then we really need those tools. But there's a lot of leeway before we get there.
Yeah, that's actually a good way to describe how conventional medicine is set up, because conventional medicine is most of the tools for conventional medicine are for the end stage of disease processes, whether it's heart disease, whether it's somebody with high blood pressure or diabetes or but not early in the process.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of the difference between, we're having a conversation at my home about early detection versus early intervention. And so I think there's a lot of people that would like to say that early intervention is getting that blood screening and looking at things like your blood pressure. And that's really, it's not early intervention, it's preventative medicine. So clarify myself. So preventative medicine versus early detection. So when you do blood screening and you're finding things like, your cholesterol is high, or you have an infection, your white blood cells are off, or your high blood pressure, that's early detection. So that means that by the time you end up within a scary number range, you're already deep within the disease, the cardiovascular disease, diabetes, all of that. By the time you trip those numbers to be noticed by conventional medicine, as you put it, it's that end stage area where we need pharmaceuticals to intervene on our behalf. But true preventative medicine are all the things that you do before you end up in that range. So things like yoga and meditation and dietary changes and drinking enough water and walking to work and detoxes. That's the true preventative medicine and sort of the difference in there.
Actually, when you first brought this the subject out just now, you used a terminology that I haven't heard before, but I actually like the terminology.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the idea. You said it, the first thing you said was early detection versus early intervention.
Mm-hmm.
I actually like the terminology of early intervention. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'm going to write that down. Has it been patented yet?
Oh, I've got some lawyers working on it.
but that's actually what it, I may be getting ahead.
No, please.
But that's what I would like to do in my practice is early intervention.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so much that can be done before the numbers go off the charts, or even before a lot of symptoms start.
Yeah.
Prevention, I guess you could say that, prevention is kind of the same thing as early intervention, but I like the idea of early intervention. The problem is in real life is that most people don't get motivated to make fundamental lifestyle changes until they have a symptom like me with my knees, right? That you just can't ignore it anymore.
Yeah. I mean, it's when it comes to lifestyle changes, it does often get weighed out between wheelchair or cheese, and if I can get away with eating my cheese as long as I can, then I think I will. And we have to have something to motivate us to change our behavior, which is a sticking point we come up to a lot in these conversations, is how I think it's a little bit needs to be bent along how can we change our expectations of what medicine and healthcare really ought to be. Because if we have this idea that early intervention or early detection, we need to wait until we are symptomatic, then we think there's almost this misconception of we are inherently healthy until we are suddenly not. I am healthy until I am diabetic.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not a light switch that gets thrown. Right. I am healthy with blood sugar that is creeping up, creeping up, creeping up, creeping up. It's sort of near that worrisome number, but I'm still fine. And then I wake up one morning and now I'm definitely not fine.
It's more like a dimmer switch.
It really is. And so how can we be aware of what's going on in our bodies and take responsibility for it in a rather unconventional medical way and say, I'm going to choose lifestyle and nutrition changes. I think really our goal should be to live a healthy and good quality life is to not find ourselves in a medical office, because that means we've let things go too far.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, I think to me, I think that if there's a way that we can give people permission to have really high standards for their health, to me, that's kind of the common thing that I see.
Yeah. I love that. Permission to have really high standards for your health.
Right. And I think that that's not at all universal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and now for me, I always just wanted to feel really good. If I didn't feel really good, I knew there was something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I've talked to people over the years that, you know, whether patients or not patients, you know, they might say, oh, I just had this nagging, you know, back pain. It's not that bad.
Mm-hmm.
Well, hello? I couldn't live with that.
Yeah.
My personal standards are, it has to be perfect. If I don't feel perfect, there's something wrong. And I've always been that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that if we can, you know, give our listeners some permission to say, look, it's possible to feel perfect.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe not absolutely perfect, but pretty close.
Well, when you start talking about with all the changes you've made, you're at 98%.
Yeah.
Like that's not 100%, and it's not going to be 98% 100% of the time, but it's definitely not 60%. It's definitely not nagging pain. And I know that I've mentioned before on the show that I have a medical history that includes having H. flu meningitis, which gave me a lot of movement issues initially right off the bat. It was when I was 9 months old. So by about the time I was a year and a half, I was still kind of falling over and running into walls and just did not have my coordination about me. And I was released from traditional medical care and PT with as good as it's going to get. This is your quality of life now.
And that's it.
And that's the standard for where it's at. And now, having done a lot of unconventional things throughout my life, I can say that, asthma aside, still working on that, work in progress. Yeah. But my movement in my body, I'm at about 95%.
Right.
I am getting really close to not being able to call myself an individual with an invisible handicaps anymore, because it's that relentless idea of, I deserve better. And frankly, so does everybody else.
Yes.
There's nothing that makes you special because you have Hashimoto's and I have brain damage. We just decided to keep asking for better.
Right.
And I would love if everybody would keep asking for better. Taking responsibility for our health means having personal accountability no matter our age. Rachel Van Pelt joined us to discuss how our needs change as we age and that I'm just getting older isn't a viable excuse anymore. Well, I think that's an interesting shift to start talking about. Is it's a conversation we don't often have in aging. It's about what we're losing and what we no longer have and the movement you shouldn't be doing because you're going to hurt yourself. When what you just said is, as you age, you need more protein and more activity to sustain your body. Mm-hmm. And that is so counterintuitive to what we've been told culturally. And I love, and perhaps we can talk about the conversations you have with your clients of what needs change, not necessarily what you can no longer do. Mm-hmm. It's an important shift, I think, that needs to happen.
I love that you brought that up, because it really is. We do see a lot of people being told, well, you just can't do that activity anymore. Mm-hmm. You just can't, you know. And so it's a slow and insidious change over time, because we start doing a little bit less of this and a little bit less of that. And it's probably at a time when we need to be doing more. we need to be doing more resistance exercise, mm-hmm. potentially to stimulate the muscle and the bone. We need to be doing more balance type exercises mm-hmm. to maintain our balance. Whereas, you know, for example, people will be, oh, you can't run anymore. Now you got to walk. Well, walking's great exercise. Don't get me wrong. And mm-hmm. most of my clients, actually, that's the primary source of exercise. But I think for a lot of people who enjoy running, being told that they can't run anymore, now, you know, it really inhibits, you know, the enjoyment and, mm-hmm. That they get out of physical activity. And resistance exercise. Not everybody likes to go to the gym and hit the weight stacks.
Yeah. But for those who do.
But in some people do. But there are other ways we have to get – I have to get really creative about ways to substitute, you mm-hmm. know, what they can and cannot do, but find ways to still stimulate the muscle and bone to the mm-hmm. same extent that when they were able to run and do balance type, you know, exercises that will affect their balance and their core strength and all those things and prevent the age-related kinds. Because simply saying, well, I can't do that anymore is going to lead to accelerated aging.
Yeah. Well, the moment mm-hmm. we quit, I mean, there's statistics out there. I wish I knew off the top of my head, but even with retirement, the moment that we stop working towards something, working towards a goal, our mm-hmm. cellular aging increases precipitously. That yeah. unless we are driving towards something, our body will slow down for efficiency. And this is on the physical level. And when you start talking about people who love to run and they're no longer told they're allowed to do that anymore, you know, that takes joy out of their life. And when we talk about an integrative approach to health and body balance, we need to have goals. We need to have joy. We need to have movement. And we're really just kind of slowly killing our aging population by removing goals and movement and happiness and saying, why are you all so sad and schlumpy?
Yeah.
And it's yeah. the story that we're telling that creates that.
Yeah.
So what do you say in working with clients when these concerns about, well, I'm older now and I can't do X, Y, and Z? How do you start changing that conversation and that expectation?
I'm glad you asked that. That, you know, mindset's a big part of it.
Mm-hmm.
First, we always ask, well, is that true? Why do you think you can't do that anymore? Mm-hmm. Who told you, you know, why, you know, was it your doctor that told you that? Or is it just because, you know, your Aunt Jane said that, well, when she got to that age, she had to stop doing that. So you probably should too. You know, so we examine the reasons why people think that they can't do certain things, because sometimes those are wrong. Mm-hmm. And we can and trainable. So you use it or lose it. So for many people, loss of physical function and mobility and ability to do things just came slowly over time, and it was a disuse type mm-hmm. of atrophy of muscle or bone, or, you know, things that, so we can do a lot to strengthen certain muscle groups that will take the pressure off the knees, for example, or the hips, and figure out ways to allow people to get back to activity. Now, maybe it is walking and not running. So mm-hmm. that sometimes those activities are very modified, but for many folks, they're surprised at what they can get back mm-hmm. with the right kind of attention. So, but mindset's important, and not just assuming that, oh, I can never run again, or I can never hike again, or I can't play golf anymore because I don't have the range of motion. A lot of times you can get that back. And so that's what we try. Yeah. Because I think the quality of life, maintaining, you know, health span is all about maintaining your highest mm-hmm. quality of life and figuring out ways. And sometimes it's alternative activities, and sometimes there are workarounds and things that you can do to get people back to the activities they love.
And it sounds like it's changing the conversation from an aging issue to a disuse issue. And mm-hmm. that's, I can imagine that can be a tough pill to swallow sometimes, that it's not that you're aging and your body is taking this away from you. It's that, in a sense, you've been taking this away from your body slowly, slowly over time. But that can be empowering because it means you can give it back and exactly. start doing what you love again.
Yes. I love the word empowering because I do think that it is very empowering for people to realize like, oh, this is not inevitable. It's modifiable. It's in my control. But it also means that you have to be accountable.
Yeah.
And that's why I said mindset's so critical. And, you know, the people I work with, you know, I absolutely insist on working with people who have a growth mindset, who are willing to be held accountable. But they get that back multifold that, you know, that, you know, being held accountable, the flip side of that is being empowered and knowing that you have some control over. Mm-hmm. And there are things that we don't have control over, certainly, but there's so much more that we can and we don't have to just chalk it up to, oh, that's just, you know, aging sucks and that's it for me. My best years are behind me, you know. And I think that's what I learned at a young age. In the research that I did, some of the early research, we were studying masters athletes and in Boulder, actually. And but what we discovered, so the masters athletes, of course, as you might expect, look better than their sedentary peers, right? In a whole host of things, cardiovascular outcomes, metabolic outcomes, endocrine outcomes. But they but what we also found is that you didn't have to be this highly trained master's athlete to get those benefits. We also studied people who are moderately active and people who started late in life. So there were, we had a lot of people who weren't athletic when they were younger and only, especially women, there were, because that generation didn't do a lot of sports back pre-Title IX, we saw a lot of people, a lot of women, postmenopausal women who picked up exercise and good nutrition habits and good sleep habits and things, you know, in their 50s and 60s and looked as healthy as those who had been athletic their whole life. And I think that is just
that's
remarkable.
And it really tells the story that it's never too late. And the idea of ever writing yourself off that it's been too much, too long, too far, the research just simply doesn't support that notion.
Absolutely.
And what a gift.
It is. What a gift. And it's so motivating. It motivated me. I mean, I was studying these, you know, these women who were, you know, in their 50s and 60s who had a VO2 max higher as high as my, if not higher than when I was in my 20s. And I was an elite athlete. And I was just and it was because they were just taking good care of themselves. So their aerobic capacity was good. Their bone density was better than mine. Like, you know, I realized like it's, you know, you can be healthier in your 50s and 60s than you were in your 20s and 30s.
Wow.
And you don't have to, you don't necessarily have to be out racing, you know, 10Ks or running marathons. Mm-hmm. That you can do that with, you know, moderate amount of physical activity and a balanced nutrition and sleep and stress management.
So that's wonderful. I mean, it really opens the door for as we age to be the kind of adult that we want to be. What are some of the common misconceptions or myths that you hear from your clients or that you see in the research getting debunked?
Yeah. I mean, I think in the common misconception is, well, it's just in my genes. You know, diabetes runs in my family, so therefore it's inevitable that I'm going to have diabetes, some version of that, whether it be diabetes or thyroid dysfunction or adrenal fatigue. Or, you know, we see a lot of things that are very common. And so then it's thought to be normal and also just inevitable because it runs in the family. And I think that conception that family history matters as much as it does. And we perpetuate that. I think we see that in the medical system because we ask people about their family history and everything. But it actually is such a small component, only determines about 20% of your risk of most disease. And even that is modifiable. So I alluded to this earlier that 70 to 80% of most of those age-related chronic diseases like diabetes, cardiovascular disease, thyroid dysfunction, adrenal fatigue, many types of cancer are completely preventable and with lifestyle modification. Now, your risk is elevated because of your family history, but that doesn't mean it's inevitable and that all of those, your lifestyle and environmental choices that you make are what's dictating whether those genes are turned on and off. And that's what we call the science of epigenetics. And so I think, you know, I, that's like the number one thing that I really try to convey to people is that you really have more control than you think. Mm-hmm. And if you have that family history, you need to all the more reason that you need to focus on lifestyle. Not, it doesn't let you off the hook. Yeah. It's just part of aging and it's just runs in my family. But actually it means you're more on the hook because you have that elevated risk. And so you need to focus on, your exercise, your nutrition, your sleep, your stress management, even more than somebody who didn't have diabetes that ran in their family.
Our current insurance model reflects our current approach to healthcare, and that is paid for time. Adam Crochane shows us how using the current model of health insurance as a catch-all for every medical need is skyrocketing our rates.
Well, and I don't want to sidetrack myself too much, but we did talk about this last time. The fundamental problem is the misuse of insurance. Mm. I mean, that I am 100% on. So, and I always use the analogies of if you have homeowner's insurance, you don't use it to get a new mat for your front door. Mm-hmm. You choose to get it or not. But you don't call your insurance agent and say, hey, listen, can you guys send some blinds over? I think I need some for the kitchen. That's idiotic. No one would do that.
But I really want to because my blinds broke.
And that's why we have freedom. Right. You want blinds? Go buy them. Mm-hmm. Or don't. Whatever.
Yeah.
But you don't misuse your homeowner's insurance because that policy would triple, quadruple overnight. Mm-hmm. So same thing with car insurance. We don't abuse it because the rates go up. Well, since the 80s, that's what we've done with health insurance. It magically covers everything. We want it to cover your chiropractor, mm-hmm. your primary care, your everything. And that's a dysfunctional system. There's no way you can fund that forever. So what happens is premiums go up, deductibles up, copays mm-hmm. up. And that's why the national average of primary care face-to-face is about 8 minutes. Mm-hmm. And we wonder why everyone's burned out, patients, providers, the whole thing. It's just so dysfunctional.
It absolutely is. And I was talking with another guest that we're going to have on the podcast mm-hmm. in a few weeks, who's a provider at Anschutz here. And it is just this pervasive burnout of doctors. And he put it yep. in the same way. As a doctor, I hadn't really thought about the patient's burnout, too.
Yes.
That everyone is dissatisfied and not getting what they want, which mm-hmm. when it comes to our health and our vitality, that seems like an absolutely backwards way to approach things.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. And whether it's direct primary care or mm-hmm. if you take cash pay for chiropractic patients or whatever it is, mm-hmm. you're going to get better quality. I can almost guarantee every single time, almost every single time. Mm-hmm. There's a few out there. But people say, why would I pay for a primary care provider? Mm-hmm. I have insurance. It's like, well, if it's working for you, keep it. Keep it that way. But most people are like, they don't listen. Mm-hmm. It took me 5 different specialists. No one talked to anybody. And it's because the timer's going every moment. Mm-hmm. So you're not just answering to a patient. You're answering to the insurance company and then to the landlord, to all these other overhead considerations. So the average insurance-based primary care, about 80% goes to overhead. The only way to make some money is see more patients. Mm-hmm. Quick, quick, quick.
And when it's just you and your body and the time of the hours in the day, you can only pinch that coin so far.
Yeah, definitely.
So how does that play out then into the hospitals then when we start talking about the overhead pay and those more expensive procedures too?
Well, and some of that, so I don't run a hospital, mm-hmm. so I don't have all the answers there as an administrator, but if your dollars that you spend on your health insurance went toward the big stuff mm-hmm. only, there'd probably be more dollars to go there. So if you need to have breast cancer treatment or an appendicitis mm-hmm. or whatever it's going to be, you use it just like your car. Mm-hmm. You get into a car accident, you use the insurance. You don't use it to get gas. Mm-hmm. And that's why the whole thing is just so messed up. I don't have all the answers, but I do know, and I've done this with my own body, and when I see different providers, mm-hmm. I had to go see I was going to see my old primary care. I just needed a referral, and they're like, well, you need to come in. I'm like, what do I need to come in for? I know. they're like, well, you haven't been here in 6 months. And at the time, I was 46 years old. I was like, I don't need to be there every 6 months. I have no issues. Mm-hmm. I'm like, sorry, it's policy. And then I went in there. I was like, well, all right, when can I get in this week? They're like, sorry, we don't have any openings. I'm like, oh, God, if I had hair, I'd pull it out. So then they were like, well, 2 weeks you can come in and see this person. I get in there. It's not that person. There's someone else covering. He was nice enough, but literally he came in, said, oh, what's your issue? Shoulder thing, whatever. He mm-hmm. jiggled my arm. In less than 60 seconds, we were in the room. He's like, oh, yeah, no problem. And I went out, and the medical assistant was like, why were you here? Why'd you come in? Why didn't you just call? And I was like, oh, God. It's killing me. So now I see a direct primary care provider. Mm-hmm. And if it's something like that, if it's appropriate, we do a Zoom call. Mm-hmm. Or we do a telephone or a text or an email because that's appropriate care, not answering to the insurance.
Yeah, I feel like the whole insurance model to me is the exemplify of like hell is other people. And I had the exact same thing happen in that, you know, I'll be 35 at the end of this month. I'm relatively healthy, but mm-hmm. I have had a profound hearing loss since I was 9 months old. Mm-hmm. That has only gotten better, but basically I've been hearing impaired my entire life. And I wanted to get my hearing tested again because it was changing. So in order to go to the specialist, I had to go to my primary care doctor yeah. so that I could tell them that I was deaf. They could agree with me, and then they could refer me to the hearing to get the hearing test. And when it comes into having to give up work, patient care,
was the appointment convenient for your job and your life?
Absolutely not. I had to miss an entire morning worth of patient care because an entire morning worth of patient care. Because you know that it's not just going to be that 10-minute appointment, right. but it could be delaying onward from that 10-minute
yep.
appointment.
You got to get there, you mm-hmm. sit there, they're running late, doing mm-hmm. whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's why the system is really set up mm-hmm. for each individual person to look out for themselves in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So your primary care, if they just talk to you on the phone and they use insurance, they don't get paid.
Mm-hmm.
So where's their piece of the pie? So you need mm-hmm. to come in. You're like, but I don't really need to see you. They're like, sorry. It's the way it works. And your insurance says, well, we don't want patients getting the bright idea that they know what's going on, mm-hmm. so they must go to the gatekeeper, primary care. And there is some truth to that. Mm-hmm. But just with the model that I do, and I didn't create it, I'm just part of it, but it takes that motivation out of it.
Yes.
You come in, you don't come in, I still make whatever I make based off of a membership model.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not my motivator. So I offered you, do you want to come in and hang out and talk? And you say, yeah, okay, fine, let's do it. There's no copay. Or you say, well, I'm kind of busy. Can we just do this, that? And again, I'm not a rubber stamp type mm-hmm. thing. We just do whatever. If appropriate, mm-hmm. we get it done.
Awesome. So we have the idea of coming in and getting the care that you need mm-hmm. and having that autonomy of body to know what is going on with you.
Yep.
And to know, because I think to some degree, knowing that you have a specialist or you have a special need, you should be able to take the agency to go get it. Now, mm-hmm. you know, we agree that there has to be a point where, you know, the doctors, the PAs, and everyone did go to a 4-year or so yep. medical degree to understand the nuances of it. But where can we find that meeting point between a person's mm-hmm. autonomy in their body and the additional education that we've gotten as medical providers?
Well, and that's where it's not only on the medical system. It's mm-hmm. it's the culture, mm-hmm. the entire culture. Because how many people do I know who say, well, yeah, but I have insurance?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I'll say, you can pay cash for that MRI, and it's mm-hmm. I can get it for $249. They're like, but I have insurance. It should mm-hmm. cover it. I'm like, but then it's going to be $1,200.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, I want the insurance to pay for it. I'm like, but you're going to pay for it. So if we can change the paradigm mm-hmm. to say all those doctors, PAs, nurses, whoever, they're not evil. They just want to do a job, take mm-hmm. care of their family, and be happy. So if we took out the financial part of it, meaning mm-hmm. if you could call up your rheumatologist
mm-hmm.
and say, hey, you had mentioned this thing about the labs. Did you want to do this? And they could just talk to you on the phone and answer what they meant.
Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So if specialists, there are some specialists that are direct pay.
Mm-hmm.
I know a cardiologist, we have an orthopedist, like all that kind of stuff. They've also said enough is enough.
Mm-hmm.
But especially for primary care, we have to be careful because, especially even with telemedicine, people ask me all the time, do you like doing telemedicine? I say, I don't love doing it with complete strangers
mm-hmm.
because you still don't have a relationship. You still have not touched the person, mm-hmm. listened to their heart, that kind of stuff. It's good for my patients. I know them. Oh, yeah, I love telemedicine. We've been doing it forever. With this, we'll sidetrack into all this COVID crazy mm-hmm. times and all this sort of stuff. Yeah, telemedicine's a big deal. And I would much rather have people have a relationship with someone that they know and mm-hmm. that they can reach out to and just get appropriate care. As opposed to, mm-hmm. and I can tell you this, I know of an urgent care, and they're probably all about this much right now, but mm-hmm. if you don't have insurance, or even with insurance, I used to have people pay $150. So they're sitting there for an hour or two, pay $150, and they need an albuterol inhaler. It's like, mm-hmm. oh, sweet. they should be able to call their primary and just mm-hmm. get it refilled. Again, if appropriate, if they're misusing their medicine or something, someone should keep track of that so that way they don't get hurt.
Yeah.
Cash pay for an urgent care, a lot of them start, walk in the door, $279. $279, that's a third or maybe close depending on age, but that's almost a third of a year membership. Come in unlimited times.
And just to go in.
yeah. Yes. Just to go in that one time. What if they need a follow-up a few days later? it's another fee. Mm-hmm. And that's why they're probably going to wait until they're really sick.
Yeah.
And it just makes me kind of sad there.
Well, and we were talking about this too. So this is a little bit of a change, but it goes into the climate of what we're in right now is mm-hmm. the idea that when the medical system is this broken and you're waiting until you're really sick yep. because that's what you can afford, it also puts the value and the urgency on you know, you're not sick until you're broken.
Yep.
And so during all of this shutdown, and yes, we can see how there is this unknown virus and mm-hmm. we don't understand the spread and we really want to contain it, but the limits put on the essential services of any medical provider, and that was chiropractic included here in Colorado, mm-hmm. I can only speak to our state here, sure. was only if it saved life, limb, or organ system.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the you're not sick until you're broken concept.
Yep.
And so the number of people that I had coming in immediately after the shutdown who were crippled to the point of being able, yeah. unable to walk,
yep.
and what that does to our immune system, our ability to cope, depression, anxiety, all the things that are going to be harder to deal with right now anyway, mm-hmm. it sets everyone up for failure in a way.
Mm-hmm. And again, I wasn't on the ground here those first couple of weeks, mm-hmm. and I think it was craziness, and I was like really on the pulse there, but when there's a crisis, yeah, you take care of the worst things first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's a mass casualty, catastrophic, terrorist mm-hmm. attack, like who cares if someone has a sniffle?
Yeah, it's the triage.
But for the most part, 99% of our life is not that.
Mm-hmm.
99.9% probably. For all the years we've been on Earth or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you're right. Everything is focused. Even conventional Western medicine is what's wrong with you? Let me give you something for that.
Mm-hmm.
And even the mindset. I see this. I have a lot of patients and friends and people saying, so how about hydroxychloroquine? How about azithromycin? And again, we're not getting into the little details because mm-hmm. it's still so unknown.
Yeah.
And I said, but what we're expecting as a culture is how are you going to fix me?
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to what the heck am I going to do to fix me?
Yeah.
And that's why I did challenge my patients. I was sending messages. So probably about a month and a half in, I said, I'm getting a lot of questions. We don't know. There's mm-hmm. like proven treatments, and there's a lot of, you know, I don't want to say conspiracy, but, you know, people say, well, I read this, study.
Yeah.
Either way, there's nothing proven. You yeah. know what is proven is being healthy. So how many of you have focused on your health in the past 6 weeks? What have you done to be better?
Mm-hmm.
And that's not me judging anybody, but have you become more active? Have you gotten more sleep? Have you worked on your stress, nutrition? Do you mm-hmm. have some purpose in life? Like, those are the five things I focus on a lot with people. And, you know, people are like, you know, actually, I'm going for more walks. Boom. Good answer.
Finally, we'll see how the healthcare system doesn't appropriately address everyone's needs. Dr. Christina Holland discusses the needs of trans patients and the problems they face in traditional medical models.
Aside from having a physical body that is somewhere on a spectrum of normal that might not be part of our textbooks, what are other barriers to healthcare that we see for non-binary folks?
Yeah, so I also see trans folks who are primarily transgender women. So they have on bottom surgery. They've had gender affirming surgeries to get the vagina that they've always wanted, which is awesome. Mm-hmm. And then teaching them how to get the most out of that is a part of my job that I really love and I'm really grateful for.
Mm-hmm.
So one, affirming care providers, and people just even knowing that's even a possibility, because there is mm-hmm. this cultural narrative and community narrative that you don't know who's safe and you don't know who's going to decide to approve or not approve of the decisions you want to make about your body based mm-hmm. on what box they think you belong in. And that mm-hmm. applies across the board, but especially for trans and non-binary folks.
And what I love about having that opportunity to teach how to use a body part that you've never had is that it also eliminates, or perhaps just shines light on, this assumption that because you now have the body that you've always wanted, it is now an innate experience of having it. I've seen in my office a lot of really interesting biomechanical changes that happen, even if it's something like a hormonal intervention and our bodies start to change. And we see someone carrying more muscle mass than they once did, or less muscle mass than they once did. And how you work and carry that change is something that we need to be taught. And in these situations, this individual perhaps didn't have an opportunity to learn it from early childhood as they might have liked. It is still something that needs to be learned.
Right. And unfortunately, there's this narrative and this fear in the community that, well, if I am not just pleased as punch with the results of this intervention, whether that's hormonal or surgical or whatever, that it means that I can't be taken seriously as an individual. And I can't be taken seriously as a woman if I'm not just the most stoked with what I happen to get in terms of genitals.
And I find that kind of ironically humorous, because if you take a look at anyone perhaps on a cisgender side of the spectrum, how often are we not happy with our bodies too? I mean, we all have the right to be unhappy with what we have or unhappy with where we are in a process of recovery. Simply arriving at a place that you'd always hope to be is not the end point. It's not the destination.
Yeah, I love something that I have just loved so much in my practice is seeing how very similar the concerns and the fears of trans women are to the concerns and the fears of cis women, which just, I think, to me, further validates that one, we're all human, and two, that we're all women, and that having the experience of being a woman is a unique experience. Fitting into what's society, being able to fit you into a box, does provide a certain amount of culture in that, and we're all in it together.
That's true. When it comes down to wanting our bodies to serve us the best, there is no gender line about that. And removing that among cis, binary, male, female, will go a long way to equalizing our experiences, I would hope.
Yeah, absolutely. But so going back to other things that can create discrepancies in healthcare, certainly access to insurance. Luckily in Colorado, we have really pretty decent Colorado Medicaid, and there still just aren't a lot of people who take it. And unfortunately, a lot of transgender people do have Colorado Medicaid because of a lot of these other structural issues in terms of being considered hireable and having jobs and socioeconomic status and all of these things, because of the way that culture perceives being trans as a disability and as a hindrance, and just without the respect that it really deserves, and with a lot of stigma that it certainly does not. So a lot of those types of things also play a huge role in people's access to care.
And I mean, the mouthful of thinking that how someone identifies within their body somehow becomes a disability to be able to do work or a hindrance to engaging in the world is in itself ludicrous. But then to see that further impact on an economic and a medical level, and you're right that here in Colorado, it's a really fortunate thing that Medicaid will accept and identify. But if you take a look at any other state that might not have that in place, that leaves a great number of people, of individuals, without healthcare and further limiting their ability to find a healthcare provider that will see them for who they are to begin with. So the resources become extremely limited.
Yeah, and we were kind of talking about this before, but so having insurance options, so having Medicaid for people here in Colorado is awesome, but that's one level. But then the next level is who is taking it and what providers can they actually access with that? And so, for example, Denver Health takes Colorado Medicaid. And so they see a lot of transgender and non-binary folks. And they're also an LGBTQ Center for Excellence, which allows for that and makes they've prioritized being a good set of providers for that population. And which is so sad to me. It's such a low bar because it's just treating people as people, but fine. There is a certain level of these types of conversations, right? Being aware of and trying to make changes in access for folks. But that, even in this weird time where a lot of people were doing telehealth and not everything was open, has disproportionately impacted people in the community. So it's just, it's important to talk about all of the levels at which, this population may or may not have access, often does not have access.
And to have this idea that, you know, and Denver Health, I mean, yes, we need more people that are held, more institutions that are held up to that level of excellence. But the fact that that remains sort of an anomaly mm-hmm. becomes a frustrating and upsetting reality. There's another major healthcare organization in Colorado, SCL Health, that is now currently working to change its EHR, its electronic health records, to now include correct pronouns for non-binary. And it's an ongoing project over several months to get medical billing and coding to simply represent an individual as they seek to be represented in their medical office, which in the absence of that, I think something that doesn't often get considered, you know, you walk in and you identify as she, your page says she, there are now, in this case, accurate assumptions about how you're representing in the medical care that you need, versus walking into an office and having your paper say she and you identifying as he or they or some other part of a spectrum. There's a lot of self-explanation and self-revealing that you might need to do in order to get care that might not have anything to do with what genitals you have in your pants.
Yeah, to perfect mm-hmm. strangers. And like, what mm-hmm. amount of safety is there going to be? Because there are certainly people who continue to be unsafe to trans and non-binary folks. And so mm-hmm. for whatever reason, political, religious, cultural, you know, whatever reason mm-hmm. it is, well, none of which are acceptable. But so it's, I think we can't overstate how hard it is for these folks to get access mm-hmm. because I think once you hear some of their stories, it makes my stomach churn sometimes mm-hmm. to be very honest with you. And it, as a provider and as someone who thinks of myself as a medical provider and considers mm-hmm. myself as part of the medical provider team, my tendency or like my gut reaction, it sometimes has been to be like, oh, that can't be right. Right. Like there must've been some sort of miscommunication. Surely mm-hmm. that didn't happen the way that you've internalized it happening, which is also not fair and not true. And mm-hmm. it takes some practice to shut that down and again, leave the space for people to tell their story and trust people, which is the same, frankly, as when people come in with stories of trauma and we have mm-hmm. to trust people to tell their own stories. I wasn't there. I'm not the expert of your body.
Mm-hmm. Which goes back to the beginning of our conversation to say, this is your body and your body autonomy to say what you are comfortable receiving based on the story that came with it. And I think there also needs to be an acknowledgement here that while we are both medical providers that are really trying to do our best by serving all populations that walk in the door, that I am a cis woman. And so my ability to engage and to speak to an experience is incredibly limited by my own experience in the medical world. There are conversations that I have just not had to have. And that means putting aside a lot of those expectations and experiences. And, you know, again, here having this conversation on behalf of a group that isn't represented right now on the podcast.
Yeah, I think that is there's no way to overstate how important that is. And mm-hmm. That was part of what I realized through my own medical journey. Not only was I learning a budding medical provider with the language, mm-hmm. I was also a cis white woman who had private insurance and a lot of education and, you know, really understood a lot of, I just had a lot of privilege on my side and I mm-hmm. still felt mistreated and felt like I wasn't respected in my medical care. So I think that also really started kind of made it was one of the building blocks to why inclusive care became a thing because mm-hmm. I realized how much privilege I had and still how mistreated I was. And so what was happening to other people?
Mm-hmm.
In our first episode with Ray Thomas from Recovery Box, we realized that even taking care of ourselves can be an act of rebellion in a culture focused on impossible standards.
Yeah, I absolutely love that. It reminds me, something we've all been talking about is there's been this mm-hmm. huge push in quarantine, I feel like, mm-hmm. to, well, what new skill have you learned? And mm-hmm. What have you gained? And, you know, this like do, how much more productive have you been? And mm-hmm. I know Aaron and I specifically have been talking, it's hit me really hard of like, I don't want that pressure. Can the goal just be to like survive through this? Mm-hmm. Like, I just want to be.
Yes.
And the pressure to kind of go, go, go and do. Mm-hmm. I am just like, over it. And I think what we've just been trying to communicate is like, just be. Mm-hmm. We just got to be and exist right now and try and get through this.
My mantra has been slow down, tune in. And that's what I think. I'm a firm believer in everything happens for a reason. And that's probably just to make me feel more comfortable about unfortunate situations.
Something to hold on to.
But it works.
It works. Finding meaning in it. And that's where I think that this experience, what it can teach me is to tune in. And really, I've realized how much I've tuned out of my own body and suppressed and pushed away and just like keep on pushing on. Past the point of like comfort with like the to-do lists that just like never stop going. And this has been actually, I feel like, this blessing in disguise for me. And I know that everybody has very different experiences with this, but it's been a real eye opener at this point so far. Who knows? Things could change.
Yeah, we're only 5 months in. No, but it is. The language is shifting from this is the acute phase, and you've only got 2 weeks of stay-at-home quarantine to, you know, become a concert pianist, so you better start now, versus, you know, we having to adapt, and we're 5 months in. We're in this chronic stage, and we can't stay in a heightened, you know, special edition form for this long. We need to find the neutral. We need to find the survivable. And when we take this particularly to the community that you all and the Recovery Box serves, we're asking about finding something survivable, manageable, neutral when already dealing with mental health and disordered coping behaviors, I think were some of the languages that we used back in January. So can we talk about finding that neutral, particularly amongst dealing with something that would be ramped up during an area of trauma?
Yeah. I mean, even just to speak to the fact that the level, you know, surveys and just also from census of treatment centers and inquiries around that, like, I know treatment centers for eating disorder wait lists are insurmountable right now. And I know for myself as a clinician, like, I'm feeling the stress, and but all that to be said, like, people are struggling with this. And it's very clear that this quarantine and the chaos in the world has increased our disordered coping habits as a community. And when you think about it too, it's like, okay, I can't control anything in my life right now. Nothing outside of me is controllable. What do I have? And sometimes that's all that is food in your body. Mm-hmm. Not always about control. There's many other reasons, right, that we use those. But I think it's just terrifying and it's scary. And people need resources that they can access in non-traditional ways now more than ever before. So that's my piece on it.
I think something too that's been incredible about the recovery community in general is everyone's kind of evolution and malleability in the way that, like, we have to shift. I think at the very beginning, kind of we were talking about in that acute phase, it was like, okay, let's just keep doing what we're doing and then we'll adjust. And now it's been, that's not going to work. So how can we evolve and how can we work together to reach these that maybe people that can't get into a recovery facility, or maybe they are quarantined at home, or how can we offer support that kind of doesn't have boundaries? And I think it's been almost a silver lining in all this is that we've learned as the Recovery Box and as an entire kind of field to be really, really flexible. And we've learned to come up with really creative ways and resources that we can still help others. And so it's been almost inspiring when we've talked with other programs, other groups, that everyone's working hard to find ways that resources can exist. So.
Oh, well, I just got a little goosebumps.
I know, I'm just feeling it too.
The amount of thinking outside the box that I'm seeing us do and the rest of the world do is really inspiring in a way, because people are still struggling and struggling more. And it's created this opportunity for, you know, the providers or the people who are here to support to sit back and say, okay, how can we channel our very creative brains to find a new way to support? Because the way that we're used to isn't working right now, and it really challenges, well, that's the way we've always done it. Because that can't work right now.
Well, and what I love about it is it's not just about now you all that have a problem, whatever category of disordered coping. And most often we point the finger at disordered eating or addictive personalities when it comes to drugs and substances. Yeah. But I think there has been a general acknowledgement that we're all in such a high place of stress and we're all coping in one way or another that may come to be disordered in an extreme. You know, like you were kind of highlighting, we can only control so much. And so if we're controlling our food and we're controlling it in a way of saying, I'm going to eat healthy in a way that my body feels fulfilled, that's controlling your food. But there can be a shadow side to that. Yeah. Same with working out, same with unplugging from the news to watch your favorite binge show. Yeah. But if that becomes all you do, there is the shadow side to all of it. So that silver lining that we keep coming to is that it normalizes coping mechanisms and then changes the way we access health and support for it, which I think is a really great gift to anybody who's been struggling.
Yeah, I didn't think about it like that, that we are really normalizing struggling because everybody does it in some way, shape, or form. That's really cool.
Yeah, now it's not just this category of you people over there. It's,
yeah.
Yeah, we all kind of suck at this.
Yeah, yeah, like we've all got something right now. And yeah, why don't we pull together to normalize it, decrease the shame and the stigma, and find better ways?
Well, and I've even wondered about if it's true for you. I know for me, some of the relationships in my life have become so much stronger because we just peeled back these layers of vulnerability and kind of sat back and said, I'm struggling right now, and was met with, well, I'm struggling too. And there was almost this like bond and this common humanity that happened in those moments. And now these, they are so much stronger relationships because of it. Have you?
100%.
Yeah.
And you say that and my mind is blown. I'm like, yes. Yeah. That has happened in every relationship. 100%.
Yeah. I was like, is there a relationship where that hasn't happened?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No.
I think it's beautiful because it is the silver lining of we've had such a problem with shame within mental health and mental illness. Yeah. And I can only hope that this kind of opening, this peeling back, the silver lining here is that we lose that shame piece and it becomes a conversation. We have conversations like this that really just open up the doors to understanding that, like, it's okay not to be okay.
Absolutely.
Well, and because it doesn't make that there's something wrong with you now in this position. It's you can't say that you are fine in this circumstance for 5 months straight before someone starts smelling the bullshit.
Yes.
And it's like, I stopped believing you back in March. So.
Yeah.
Well, and that also makes me think of when we, you know, that pressure to feel like we're doing okay.
Yeah.
You know, we're keeping it all together. But also, for me, that pressure to feel like I'm being productive. Mm-hmm. And I think when emotions are so high, it's really hard to maintain that level of productivity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I am also hopeful that maybe this experience kind of removes that expectation that we need to be as productive as we have been. And that might create like a more sustainable